Mark Galanter from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I won't list all of his achievements and credentials because that will take the full hour, except to say that he is among the leaders in the Law and Society movement and the efforts to bring empirical research to bear on questions that have traditionally been tackled by lawyers in a less empirical, shall we say, somewhat more seated advanced manner. And for his efforts, really one of perhaps if not the leading empiricists, legal analysts we have in the academy. I want to thank Mona Frederick and the Robert Penn Warren Center for the Humanities for co-sponsoring Mark's talk. The talk, as you know, will be about his new book, Lowering the Bar: Lawyer Jokes and Legal Culture, which on its face is a humorous topic, but I suspect there may be more of a serious payoff. After Mark's talk, we'll have time for question and answer, and then there'll be a reception outside in the hallway afterwards, at which you can, if you are sufficiently enthralled, purchase a copy of Mark's book out there. So without further ado, Mark Lynch.
Thank you very much, Dan. It's a great pleasure to be here and to have a chance to reconnect with some old friends and colleagues. I want to talk today about lawyer jokes, but put it in this context. Lawyers really bestride American public life. Law has become the kind of wall-to-wall master orderer of our society. And by that, I don't mean that law actually determines the course of what happens in other social institutions, but that it provides the site and the idiom for debate about those institutions, and it influences them as monitor, as model, and as intervener. Now, unsurprisingly, not everyone is thrilled about the centrality of law and the emergence of lawyers as the dominant profession in American society. In fact, almost no one is happy about it, except, and not even lawyers, really. It's something that's deeply resented by other elites and is irritating to ordinary people. So we lawyers find ourselves in a curious position, flourishing, indispensable, but resented and demoralized. Now, one of the prominent manifestations of the current swell of anti-lawyer sentiment is the great proliferation of jokes about lawyers and the employment of these jokes in the service of attacking lawyers and the legal system. Well, can we learn something from jokes? And obviously, we don't look to jokes for a balanced presentation about the profession. By their nature, jokes focus on flaws, weaknesses, and pretensions. And as a medium of fathoming life in its entirety, jokes have obviously very severe limitations. They're short, don't permit any development of character, they're one-dimensional. They don't reflect the human situation in all its complexity. And as comic productions, they diminish rather than ennoble their subjects. So lots of the profound dimensions of human existence are neglected here. But there are other features of jokes that make them a very good indicator of perceptions of society and its lawyers. First, jokes carry messages that are not fully apparent to teller and listener. They avoid the censorship that screens out open expression of scandalous and reprehensible views. Secondly, the sentiments in jokes have to be shared rather than idiosyncratic. That is, jokes don't register transient individual perceptions about lawyers, but shared perceptions that are ratified and confirmed by successive telling. So the persistence of jokes is a useful indicator of enduring patterns of sentiment because jokes are labile social productions which are remade at each telling and are neither controlled nor supported by organizational sanctions or authoritative texts. So they stand on their own as shared and enduring collective representation. At the same time, jokes remain the possession and voice of individuals, while the production of news, music, even fairy tales nowadays are administered by formal organizations. There's no Time Warner or Disney of jokes. The small scale and cheapness that make them unattractive as a profit center leaves jokes as one of the redoubts of individual expression. For this reason, their perspective on lawyers and jokes, you'll find, is very different than that in media more subject to corporate packaging and corporate control, like TV, movies, and so on. So lawyer jokes have a long history, and for the most part, a long half-life. There's scores of jokes in circulation today that would have been familiar to our counterparts two centuries ago. But lawyer jokes haven't always been a very prominent part of the joke corpus. Historically, the group that attracted the most jokes were the clergy. The clergy has declined as a target of jokes, and lawyers have risen. And certainly since the 1980s, turning point in the history of lawyer jokes. And so we've come into a time of a great profusion of jokes about lawyers, so many that there are even meta jokes about lawyer jokes. Like, how many lawyer jokes are there? Just three. The rest are all documented case histories. So there's lots more jokes, and we'll come to some examples. But I want to remind you, as you surely know, that jokes aren't the only thing that there's a lot more of in the last 25 years. There's been a dramatic enlargement of almost every aspect of the legal world. The amount and complexity of legal regulation, the frequency of litigation, the amount of tenor of authoritative legal material, the number, coordination, and productivity of lawyers, the number of legal actors and the resources they devote to legal activity. There's a tremendous increase in spending on law. The amount of information about law, the velocity with which it circulates, all these have increased dramatically in this last quarter century. More people use law, more people experience it, it's penetrating more areas of life as they live and observe it. So there's this great increase in the activity of real lawyers, and paralleling the increase in lawyers is a perhaps even greater increase in images and perceptions of lawyers, of imaginary lawyers, on TV and novels and movies and advertisements and news reports and so on. This great flood of the legalization of life that has taken place in the recent past. And my argument is that that's what lawyer jokes are really about. Before 1980, the great preponderance of jokes about lawyers belonged to what I call the enduring core, a set of themes about lawyers corrupting discourse, fleecing clients, fomenting strife, compromising justice, summed up in stories about lawyers sort of fraternizing, being playmates of the devil. But for the most part, it was fairly lighthearted. As I say, in this enduring core, perhaps the two really, by far the largest categories were the things that lawyers did with about talk and about money. On the whole, lawyers' linguistic dexterity was not counted in their favor. Lawyers are long-winded, they obfuscate, they split hairs, they confound ordinary sense, they lie. But there's a counter current of appreciation in a lot of these stories. Appreciation of the lawyers' resourcefulness, eloquence, persuasiveness. For example, in a story, a very old story of this particular version is from about 1870, about a guy who's being charged with stealing a horse, and his lawyer makes a very powerful plea to the jury, and the jury acquits him. And so after the acquittal, they're walking out of the courtroom, and the lawyer puts his arm around the client and says, "Tell me, Bill," he says, Nothing bad can happen to you now. It's just between you and me. Did you steal that horse? You did, didn't you?" I says, "Well, Judge," he says, he says, "I was thinking all the time," he says, "that I did steal that horse." He says, "But when I heard your speech to that there jury, I'd be doggone if I don't have my doubts about it." Well, this story, which actually goes back to, it's really an ancient story, but it's been in circulation a long time, and I think it's a nice example of the combination of the thread of appreciation that's there with this concern about the weird things that lawyers can do with language. Here's a recent addition to the great cluster of jokes about lawyers' talk, which tilts the emphasis from the lawyer's discursive prowess to his malleability and opportunism. And this has to do with a familiar scenario. The search committee is interviewing the three finalists for the presidency of the university: a mathematician, a sociologist, and a lawyer. Well, the mathematician is ushered in first to this meeting, and comes into the room, and the committee members just pepper him with all these questions about his views on the state of higher education, the university's financial prospects, his theories of educational leadership, and so forth. And just as he's about to leave, a previously silent elderly member of the committee asks, excuse me, sir, one question. Can you tell us how much is 2 and 2? Well, says the mathematician, that's really rather a complex question, but for the present purposes, we can say if you take an abstract 2 and combine it with another abstract 2, you get an abstract 4. Well, he leaves, the next candidate comes in as a sociologist, and after he's quizzed on his views about administering the university, just as he's about to leave, the same committee member pipes up with the same question: how much is 2 and 2? And after pondering a moment, the sociologist says, that's an empirical question that requires very careful collection and analysis of data, but surprisingly there hasn't been a lot of research done, but roughly the range is from 3 to 5 with a mean of about 4. And he leaves too, and the lawyer comes in, and he's questioned at great length about his views, and he turns to leave, and he just has his hand on the knob opening the door. This elderly member manages to say, "Excuse me, one more question, how much is 2 and 2? And the lawyer stops in his tracks, closes the door, turns, slowly approaches the committee, in a very soft voice, he says, "How much would you like it to be?" Well, this is actually a joke that it appears as a lawyer joke about 1982. It, for a long time before that, it flourished in Eastern Europe as an anti-communist joke about basically how much is 2 and 2, whatever the party says, in various elaborations. But this is a nice example, seemed to me, of an adapted joke. It's not merely a switch in which the lawyer is substituted for the politician or the employer. The lawyer version really reveals a very distinctive twist. What's distinctive about the lawyer protagonist is his readiness to put his ability to reshape reality at the service of the client. He's solicitous. "How much do you want it to be? he closes the door, he speaks softly, and other versions he pulls down shades or checks for hidden microphones. In contrast to the laborious mechanical responses of the other candidates, the lawyer seeks out the need behind the question. He immediately takes the request as expressing some purpose of the questioner and indicates his willingness to serve that undisclosed purpose. This responsiveness to clients is the thing that people like most about lawyers. The lawyer is entirely focused on your problem and entirely committed to be your champion. Now, people may have anxieties about whether he's going to be a distracted or faithless champion, but this portrait of the lawyer as the available champion is quite specific to the American lawyer. The joke, like almost all these jokes, exists all over the English-speaking world, but is not told about lawyers or where it is. Just doesn't have that element of the lawyer's desire to satisfy. Anyway, as I say, jokes about lawyers, things that lawyers can do with language, are rivaled in number only by jokes about their pursuit of money, which portrays them as formidable economic predators, unwilling to move without fees, and quite inventive in arranging matters to prolong their exactions. Among the most widespread and distinctive of the jokes about predation is that based on the equation of the lawyer with that emblematic predator, the shark. This goes back a couple of centuries. Sharks, well, I won't go into the history of it, but say by the middle of the 20th century, this theme was the basis of an elaborate narrative, a minister, a scientist, and a lawyer who are adrift on a life raft in the tropics, and at last they sight land, but the wind dies down, and they're afraid they're going to just sort of blow away and not be able to reach this little island. So the lawyer, seems to be a good swimmer, volunteers to swim to shore with a line and pull the raft to land. So the minister kneels and prays for his safety. The lawyer dives in. As he starts toward land, they see this black fin of a shark making straight for him. The shark disappears and comes up on the other side, having passed right under the swimmer. Then an even bigger shark darts toward him, but again swerves away. After the lawyer reaches shallow water and starts to pull the line in, the minister says to the scientist, you see, you doubter, there's proof, the power of prayer. Power of prayer, hell, says the scientist. That's just professional courtesy. Well, and starting in the 1970s, that's an old 1940s version, starting in the 70s, the sharks actually salute the lawyer by formally escorting him. But this shark image testifies to the ferocity and power of the lawyer. As in many jokes, I think there's even we can even detect a little undertone of appreciation here. The story's a tribute to the lawyer's capacity to pull off a risky, difficult feat for the benefit of his clients, so to speak, as well as himself. But recently, jokes about lawyers' predation have taken on a much darker tone. Doctor, a lawyer, and an architect are arguing about who has the smartest dog. And they decide to settle the issue by getting all the dogs together and on a nice Saturday morning out in the country, seeing which one could perform the most impressive feat. So they go out and agree that doctor's, the architect's dog is going to go first. So the architect goes and takes a huge a box of toothpicks, dumps it on the ground, and says, okay, go to it, slide rule, and the dog runs over, and in just minutes, takes all these toothpicks and constructs a scale model of the cathedral at Chartres. The architect yeah, like everybody's ooh and ah. The dog trots back to his owner, the architect gives him a cookie. Everyone is so dazzled with this. So it's now the turn of the doctor's dog. The doctor says, go to it, Sawbones, and the doctor dog trots out, sees a pregnant cow standing in the field, goes and tips it over, performs a cesarean section, and sews up the mother, and everything is fine. Comes again, trots back to the doctor, and again the onlookers are amazed, and the dog, the dog's owner gives him a cookie. Well, it's the turn of the lawyer's dog. So the lawyer says to his dog, okay, loophole, go for it. And the lawyer's dog goes over, smashes the cathedral, mauls the calf, screws the other two dogs, takes their cookies, and goes out to lunch. So you see, here we have the other dogs mirroring their masters are destructive and helpful. The lawyer's dog is destructive and predatory. He not only contributes nothing, but appropriates the other's deserved rewards and violates them personally. I think this joke, which actually starts out as a joke about two kinds of people, trade unionists and government workers. So you can sort of see lawyers have been slipped into this particular category. But it's a joke that captures, it seems, the intense indignation of professionals and business people who feel attacked, hemmed in, and overcharged by lawyers. And it reflects resentment, and it becomes a lawyer joke in the early 80s, and reflecting the resentment at the emergence of medical malpractice, product liability, civil rights, wrongful discharge, all the sorts of litigation that expose America's managers and authorities to what they feel is unwanted and unwarranted accountability, and that intensify their dependence on, not only are they attacked by one set of lawyers, but they become uncomfortably dependent on another set. So I think the dog joke paints the lawyer's predation on a very wide canvas. It's not just a matter of lawyers victimizing individual clients or opponents, but destroying social assets and unraveling the social fabric. So if lawyers were once seen as pillars of the establishment, by the late 1980s, there's a historic reversal, and they're scorned now by major sections of American elites as enemies of prosperity and order. So what's happened is that these are two examples I've given you, the university president selection and the dogs contest. These are developments in what I call the core categories of lawyer jokes. But and there's been a great elaboration of those categories. Many, many jokes have been added to them since 1980. But even more dramatically, what's happened is there are whole large new clusters of jokes about new themes, about lawyers as betrayers of trust, as morally deficient, as objects of scorn, as present in pestilential numbers, and as candidates for extermination that have appeared since 1980. What do you call 6,000 lawyers at the bottom of the sea? I think probably everybody knows this, but a good start, right? Did you hear the good news and the bad news? The good news is a busload of lawyers ran off a cliff. The bad news is there were 3 empty seats on the bus. These are interesting because these jokes get applied to lawyers, and they were originally racist jokes. They become lawyer jokes in the 80s. What's the difference between a dead snake lying in the road and a dead lawyer lying in the road? There's skid marks in front of the snake. This is actually one of the best known jokes about lawyers, and it adds to the satisfaction of contemplating the death of a lawyer, the additional satisfaction of confirming the contempt for lawyers and the impulse to eliminate them is so widely shared. So you know, the whole new set of themes, which I guess are sort of mapped out in what's probably the single most prevalent of all current lawyer jokes. Why have research labs started using lawyers instead of rats in their experiments? Well, there are really three reasons. First, there are more of them. Secondly, the lab assistants don't get so attached to them. And third, there are some things a rat just won't do. Now, this story offers a convenient vehicle, clearly, for voicing a number of interrelated points about lawyers in a wonderfully condensed fashion. And the association of rats, of course, suggests moral deficiency and betrayal. The responsible lab assistants depicts the low public regard for lawyers. Their abundance suggests the need for something to be done about too many lawyers. Some things rats won't do points to their moral deficiency and so forth. So it's a wonderful economy that this is all packed together. And the setting, of course, reminds us that this is the revenge of the laboratory classes. The scientists and the doctors who preside in laboratories and worry about getting cut up by lawyers on cross-examination, and now they finally lawyers make a positive contribution when reduced to experimental animals. And of course, so what the joke relishes is this fantasy of the diminishment of lawyers and their wholesale removal from social life. Well, now, how can we account for the appearance of all these new jokes that celebrate killing lawyers and scorn for lawyers? And remember that there are kindred legends about outrageous claims and loony verdicts, and the U.S. has 70% of the world's lawyers, and we have this horrendous litigation explosion in which everyone is suing everyone, that come along at just the same time as these jokes. What does all this tell us about public perceptions of lawyers and the legal system? Well, the most prevalent theory is probably what we might call the bad behavior theory, that the great explosion of lawyer jokes reflects a downturn in the quality of lawyers' behavior. Lawyers are treating people badly, so the public is so exasperated that their grievances have escalated into homicidal fantasies. But I think this is very implausible. First of all, we have some public opinion surveys about attitudes, about people's experience with lawyers, and it hasn't registered any significant decline in people's reported satisfaction with the legal services that they get. Secondly, if there was an increase in the intensity of people's concrete complaints about lawyers, if that was what was driving the great surge of lawyer jokes, we'd expect the new additions to somehow reflect these grievances. But the new additions, which prominently include these jokes about the death of lawyers and scorn for lawyers, are for the most part quite remote from any concrete complaints about specific kinds of lawyers. There's no joke about coupon settlements or destroying documents or signing off on fake transactions, any of the bad things we read about lawyers doing in the press. There are no jokes about those things. The jokes are about lawyers in a very generic sense. Just being lawyers, it seems to be the grievance that people have. Well, so say, it seems to me the common element in the jokes we've examined is a fantasy about the removal of lawyers from society by death or banishment from the moral community. And there's much attention to numbers, the more the better, you know, busloads, thousands, whatever. But what's the appeal of this? Why does it tickle people? You could say, well, maybe it's revenge that lawyers are somehow punished for their sins, but as I say, they're not really very specific about lawyers' misdeeds. And it seems to be it's the removal of lawyers that's really the central point. Well, what's so good about their absence? We're freed from their exactions. well, maybe their absence means that we're free from the constraints of law and we can sort of do what we want. This notion of unbridled anarchy might be, or probably was, what Dick the Butcher and Jack Cade, they're the two thugs in Shakespeare's Henry VI, Part Two, who utter the truly the urtext of anti-lawyerism, you know, first thing we'll kill all the lawyers. And these are very bad guys indeed in the original. But I think they may have said, gee, you know, get rid of the lawyers, we can do what we want. I don't think that's how we should read the American temper about lawyers. Americans don't want to be rid of law. They want to be rid of lawyers' law, a formal, complex, artificial law that only lawyers can understand. And the notion is somehow that if we could get rid of lawyers, if we had fewer lawyers, we could return to a better law that is simple, natural, direct, understandable. And lawyers are seen as the obstacles interposed between us and a harmonious, natural state of social order. And this notion of a world without lawyers is an enduring dream of making language transparent, eliminating ambiguity, dispensing with the need for interpretation. I think is widely shared, but the increasing volume and complexity of laws obviously swept us very far from this idol. We may be enchanted by this notion of a neighborly world of communal accord based on common sense and in harmony with a divinely inspired natural order, but at the same time our lives are woven into this highly technical, global world with its boundless web of unstable, man-made complexity, specialization, indirect relations, dependence on remote and unknown actors, a world whose sinful players aren't natural human persons at all, but artificial persons, a world whose dazzling promises of prosperity, excitement, and autonomy hold us in thrall. Now, I think most of us have no intention of forsaking that big world, but we resent and fear many things that accompany it. The threat of economic convulsion rippling from a distant source, the need to navigate a labyrinth of rules, the dependence on intermediaries, the need for indirection and formality. So even if we don't draw the easy conclusion that all these vexations are an imposition by lawyers, lawyers do seem to have such an affinity for them that we imagine somehow that eliminating, or at least minimizing, diminishing lawyers would somehow free us from the net of artifice in which we're ensnared and restore us to a world of spontaneous human order. So I'm arguing that the great profusion of anti-lawyer jokes can be explained as a response to the increasing legalization of society manifested both in the ubiquity of lawyers and the pervasiveness of law. Well, what can be done about it? What should be done about it? I think the answer to both those questions is nothing. Bad behavior is the source of intensified lawyer joking. It should be addressed because it's bad behavior, not because of the jokes. But if the real source of public discontent is the pervasiveness of law and lawyers, it's hardly going to be assuaged by better behavior on the part of lawyers. The legalized, quote, global world is going to be with us for a while, and the alternatives of isolationism, Fortress America, look even worse. But there's no sign, I think, that our dependence on law and lawyers is going to decrease anytime soon. So the jokes are there. They're really a canary in our coal mine. And we should listen carefully to what they tell us. We shouldn't be distracted, it seems to me, from addressing the genuine discomforts and dangers of the legalized world by campaigns to polish the image of lawyers. Jokes, after all, are just that. They're jokes, they play with aggression. They're about mock shocks, mock frights, mock aggression, mock rule breaking. And as such, they provide us, it seems to me, a very useful starting point for investigating the serious. But we shouldn't confuse them with the far more powerful ideological and material forces that are shaping the world. Thank you.